right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world. Happy Monday, everybody. Today is January 5th, 2026. And the top story this morning, unless you have been hiding under a rock all weekend, you probably know by now that Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, was seized over the weekend by U.S. Special Forces in a rather brazen and, let's say it, wildly successful raid. So here's what happened. Operation Absolute Resolve, it was called. More than 100 aircraft, helicopters, planes, drones, Delta Force operators swooped into Venezuela relatively unmolested and seized Maduro and his wife in the middle of the night, took him out of the country onto U.S. Navy ships, and he's now in New York being indicted, standing trial. So, I mean, they just grabbed him in the middle of the night. Venezuela did not or could not put up much of a fight. We don't really know how much of it was could not. We don't know how much of it was did not. The Venezuelan military, somebody in the Venezuelan military was obviously helping us. Certain arrangements were made ahead of time. It's really the only explanation for a complete lack of a showing by any Venezuelan defenses. The only attempts to defend President Maduro of Venezuela were made by the Cuban mercenaries who were part of his personal security detail. And when Cuban mercenaries take on American Delta Force operators, you can imagine how that went. Not so good for the Cuban mercenaries. They are dirt napping right now. Most of the Venezuelan military just was a no-show for this one. Also, a lot of rather advanced and highly touted Chinese stealth hunting radar that they were supposedly equipped with was going to be, Venezuela is going to be able to shoot down the American stealth fighters. No, didn't. Either didn't work or wasn't even turned on. I don't know what was what. But not a very good showing by the Soviet and, I guess I shouldn't say Soviet, Russian and Chinese made air defenses did not even show up to the fight. Now, the reaction was pretty interesting over the weekend. Venezuelans were clearly very happy about this. First thing in the morning on Saturday, you could hear tens of thousands of people screaming and cheering out their windows in Venezuela. Honestly, it seems like the only people who were upset about this were the socialists in America who were clinging to their emotional support armadillos because they just lost their wannabe commie dictator in Caracas. Don't worry, you guys, if it makes you feel any better, we did just install one in New York City. So, you know, you've got that. It's not a total loss for you guys. But it is pretty clear that the Venezuelan people were not disappointed to see Maduro go. Now, that being said, this raises all kinds of moral and ethical questions. Let's be honest. The American military and the American government, we are now in the business of regime change again. I thought we were done with that. All right, for better or worse, we're in it now, and we're doing this. I thought we weren't going to do this anymore, but the time to have that debate apparently is over. So it is done. Also, the question of like parading Maduro through the streets in New York, that kind of has like Caesar and Hercegedorik vibes. Like we're not supposed to parade people through the streets and like have little victory. I mean, is President Trump going to wear a purple cape and, you know, have the Praetorians march with him? That optics of that aren't great. Obviously, it was meant to show American dominance and to belittle Maduro and make him look weak. Yeah, I get all that. It's effective psychology. It's just I thought we weren't doing that anymore. Apparently, we are. Also, there's remaining questions like you break it, you bought it, right? We're now making decisions in Venezuela, even though Maduro's vice president is now in charge in Venezuela. So other than Maduro's gone, effectively not much has changed on the ground in Venezuela, with the exception of President Trump over the weekend pretty much said, okay, vice president lady, you're in charge. If you don't do what we want, we'll pretty much kill you. That seems to be the messaging coming from D.C. right now, saying the U.S. is in charge, all right, and Maduro's vice president is going to administer things. There's also the question of a lot of Iranian operatives on the ground in Venezuela. Hezbollah has a large established presence in Venezuela right here in our backyard. Are they just going to sit quietly, or are we going to have like this guerrilla uprising on our hands And is it even our problem to deal with? It shouldn't be, but we did kind of break it, so we did kind of buy it. We don't know what's going to happen on the ground in Venezuela right now. And there's also the fact that Venezuela is a nation of dumpster diving. There is extreme rampant poverty in that country, and you break it, you bought it. If we run things in Venezuela now, that means it's kind of on us, doesn't it? And so the moral ethical questions of what do you do about the rampant poverty in a country you claim to have just taken over? Do you do nothing about it and therefore you're allowing it? Or do you try to fix it with your own resources? Well, we have plenty of problems here in America that we need to deal with. All kinds of moral and ethical questions. We're not going to solve that here. We're not going to solve that in the comments on a YouTube channel. But if you want to vent, be sure and let me know down in the comments, guys. Just keep it civil, all right? Like, let's don't turn it into a CF, please. Now, there's also a lot of geopolitical consequences involved here, and they are immense. What happened over the weekend was historic, and it was significant. Oil is the big one. Let's not pretend this was about drugs, okay? I know that's how we sold it to people. Or at least we're not saying we're going to bring you freedom or democracy. No, this was oil. It was 100% oil. That is why we did that. Also, the Monroe Doctrine has been once again enforced. They're trying to call it the Donroe Doctrine now, whatever that means. People from the other side of the world getting involved in South America, getting involved in this hemisphere, historically has not gone very well. This time was no exception. And the big question is, what is OPEC going to do here? Or what can OPEC do here? Between the U.S. and Venezuela, that is now a major chunk of global oil reserves appear to be outside of OPEC's influence. Venezuela is a founding member of OPEC. And I am assuming, as a consequence of what happened over this weekend, that Venezuela will be promptly leaving OPEC. At least, what's the point of calling the shots in that country if we're going to allow them to continue to rig energy prices, usually to the detriment of the United States? So the big losers over the weekend, besides Maduro, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and China. Those are three big losers here. China had actually, they had a delegation on the ground in Venezuela. They had just had this big meeting strengthening ties between Venezuela and China. And then we came in while they were still there and just seized their president. The Russians had this defense pact with the Venezuelans, strengthening military ties. How's that going for you? Not so well, apparently. But the real reason that we did this was because of the Red Sea, in my opinion. I think it's not a coincidence that we immediately started sending assets to the Caribbean shortly after we pulled out of the Red Sea. The fight in the Red Sea did not go well for us. Now, we didn't lose many people. We didn't lose none of our ships were hit, but we also expended a lot of very valuable ammunition. One of our carriers had to maneuver so hard to avoid a Houthi missile that an F-18 fell off of the elevator deck. We were blowing up $20,000 drones with $2 million interceptors. It was not a winning fight. It was not a fight we could sustain, which means we learned the lesson in the Red Sea that we cannot guarantee the flow of oil out of the Middle East if it ever came down to a World War III scenario where the Iranians decided they're going to close the Strait of Hormuz and the Houthis did the same thing in the Bab el-Mandeb. We just could not guarantee that. We didn't have the ammo and the money to do it. And so what did we do? We went right to Venezuela and we took over and we said that oil's pretty much ours now. That's what we did. We took the oil. I'm sure we're going to pay royalties to Venezuela and I'm sure the money will start flowing into Venezuela. The economy there can't get any worse, can it? I hope not. But that being said, oil majors are spiking today. ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Halliburton, Schlumberger, all the kind of companies that would come in and rebuild this infrastructure are doing great today, although the price of oil is barely moving. I was kind of expecting the price of oil to head lower. If you're a Saudi Arabia, if you're Iran, what do you do? Do you sit here and wait for that Venezuelan oil infrastructure to get rebuilt and capture your own market share? Or do you try to do something like flood the world with oil supply to crash the price and prevent that investment from ever happening? I don't know. Can they even do that? A lot of these countries have been struggling to meet their own output quotas, so maybe they can't flood the world with oil supply even if they want to. More questions than answers, guys. But that was absolutely historic. And if you're China right now, your allies and your sphere of influence no longer possesses the capacity to strangle the U.S. by cutting off their oil supply. You can't do it. The Iranians can do whatever they want in the Middle East. We'll be getting our oil from Venezuela. It's going to take a few years. It's not going to happen overnight. Probably take at least 3, maybe 5 years to really get that Venezuelan oil flowing, assuming things go well. But once that happens, the Chinese and the Iranians are helpless to control the energy supply to the United States. There's nothing they can do about it. They can't cut it off to Europe either, because the Europeans can buy the Venezuelan oil, which means the United States, in a hypothetical conflict in the Pacific, would possess the capacity to cut off the flow of oil into China, and the Chinese could do nothing about the flow of oil to the U.S. That is a huge geopolitical advantage that was just developed over the weekend. So, you know, look, you can say what you want about international law, the moral and ethical dilemmas that we're now faced with. Absolutely valid arguments to be had and debates to be had. At the end of the day, the geopolitical picture has shifted dramatically in the world. And look, the world is steaming towards World War III, guys. We've been building up to this for quite a while. So like the whole clutching of pearls and international law and doing what's right is very quickly giving way to how do we make sure we come out on top of this fight. That is what happened over the weekend. A couple of other things going on. We've got tankers are trying to run the blockade in Venezuela right now. Like 16 different tankers all decided at the same time they're going to get out of Dodge, try to get out of there. Somebody on Polymarket made a ton of money betting on this Maduro thing before it happened. That's interesting. Basically, legalized insider trading happening on Polymarket. And we got some other news. Auto sales are expected to slip this week. We'll be talking about that with Lux Ganapathy from Unicus Research later today on the channel. We've got a big fraud in Mississippi. We've got Tyson Foods paying $82 million to settle price rigging of beef. Doesn't mean they're not going to do it anymore because they're admitting no wrongdoing while they're doing it. We've got Foxconn sees a 22% jump in revenue, and AI-driven inflation is the big risk to watch out for in 2026. A lot to talk about this morning, guys. Why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's see what's going on in the world of finance today. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the YouTube algorithm if you're new here, so you can come on back tomorrow and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this one every single day. Right now, stocks are looking good ahead of the opening bell, up about 27 points in the S&P 500, or 0.39% higher. The Dow is also in the green this morning, up 62 points, or 0.13% higher. But the index making the big move is the NASDAQ, up 207 points, 0.82% higher. It is risk on in stocks. That's interesting. Stocks up this morning, and the dollar is up this morning, although dollar has had a pretty wild ride over these last few minutes here. Up 27 basis points, 98.69 for the DXY. We were up more than 40 points at one point. Something happened around 8:40 a.m. that took the dollar down by about 20 basis points. I'm not sure what that was, but we'll keep an eye out for that. Looking over at the bond market, it is quiet this morning. Even though we are risk on in stocks, we got the 30-year yield barely moving, 4.867%. That is up a fraction of 1 point. The 10-year yield is down a point and a half to 4.175%. The 2-year yield is at 3.465. That is also down a point and change. And the 1 month is at 3.632, off by a half a point. Bitcoin had a pretty good day yesterday and a pretty good night. We're currently sitting at $92,700 as priced on Coinbase. Bitcoin has traded higher 4 days in a row now. Seems ample liquidity for the moment, up from 87,000 on Thursday afternoon. Went as high as 93,000 yesterday. And looking over at the commodities board, we've got metals are looking good this morning. Spot gold is up 95 bucks, $4,425, 2.2% higher. And the February COMEX gold futures are at 44.37. That's up $107, or 2.5%. Silver making another big move this morning. That volatility is still running rampant. Spot silver, 76.47, up by $3.82, 5.25% higher. March COMEX silver futures doing even better than that, 76.30, up $5.31, or 7.5% higher. I like the shiny. Once again, guys, I'm going to reiterate my warning. Be careful. There is just a tidal wave of utter, complete nonsense and outright bullshit flying around in the silver space right now. I am working on figuring out who it is that is doing this. I have a couple of ideas. Whoever they are liars. If you see anything pertaining to silver coming from this AI Asian guy, ignore it. He is lying to you. There are plenty of reasons to want to own silver. There are plenty of reasons why I am personally long silver. But all the crap that's being pumped by these phony AI videos is garbage. It's meant to deceive you. Don't fall for it. Copper, meanwhile, higher by 4%. Platinum higher by 6.4%. Palladium higher by 5.1%. And interestingly enough, crude oil is relatively flat this morning, up 61 cents, about 1%, $57.93 for February WTI futures. I was kind of expecting oil to be a lot lower this morning, to be honest with you. I thought the world would be optimistic about the flow of Venezuelan oil, but it seems it's taking a very realistic approach to this, that it's going to take a couple of years to really get any tangible movement in that Venezuelan oil production. And that's even if things go well. So right now, oil markets don't really care. Just taking a look at the silver chart here, guys. We had shown this descending triangle. This is looking at hourly candles on the silver chart. We have now broken out of that pattern. So it looks like silver is set to resume higher here. That was a pretty ugly chart, but we broke up. Keeping an eye on that. Gold, the uptrend is absolutely intact. We bounced right off of that support level that has been in place pretty much since, over the summer. So gold is looking really good here. And the gold to silver ratio has been very volatile over these last couple of days, currently moving lower, 57.65 for the gold to silver ratio. All right, let's talk a little bit about what is going on here. This one in Bloomberg Opinion, Trump now has his very own oil empire. This is by Javier Blas, who's the big commodities guy over at Bloomberg. And he's not wrong here. Let's do the math. Start with the oil production of the U.S. and add Canada, then include Venezuela and the rest of Latin America from Mexico to Argentina and everywhere else in between, Brazil, Guyana, Colombia. Like it or not, all of them are living under the Donroe Doctrine, an increasingly belligerent Washington sphere of influence over the Americas. Together, they account for nearly 40% of the world's oil output. Then it's a choice of language to describe what the U.S. administration will do with all those barrels. It may try to exert direct control, as in Venezuela, or oversee, influence, and simply enjoy the benefits of what's produced. Whatever the word, President Donald Trump now has his very own oil empire. And guys, that 40%, that is just the world's oil output. Keep in mind, Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves, even though they are only 18th in the world in oil production, because socialists did what socialists always do. They ran it into the ground and freaking ruined it. And that's why Venezuela, despite having more oil than anybody in the world, is only 18th at actually producing it. Assuming that improves with American oil majors moving into the area, we should see that only increase. And if you're OPEC, you have a hard time controlling the price of oil when half of the world's supply doesn't want to be in your little club. And I'm assuming here that Venezuela won't be members of OPEC for much longer. Otherwise, what the hell did we even do there? Now, meanwhile, we've got this one going on in the New York Times this morning. Sanctioned oil tankers flee Venezuela in defiance of U.S. blockade. The ships are using deceptive tactics as part of a seemingly coordinated attempt to bypass American naval forces in the region. All of these shadow fleet tankers are just trying to get out of Dodge here, and they're trying to overwhelm the blockade. Figure some of them will get nabbed, some of them will get through. There's a picture of three of them now. At least 16 oil tankers hit by U.S. sanctions appear to have made an attempt to evade a major American naval blockade on Venezuela's energy exports over the last 2 days, in part by disguising their true locations or turning off their transmission signals. For weeks, the ships had been spotted on satellite imagery docked in Venezuelan ports, according to an analysis by the New York Times. But by Saturday, in the wake of President Maduro's capture by U.S. forces, all were gone from those locations. Four have been tracked by satellite sailing east 30 miles from shore using fake ship names and misrepresenting their positions, a deceptive tactic known as spoofing. These four have left port without the interim government's authorization, according to internal communications from Venezuela's state-owned oil company and two people in the Venezuelan oil industry who spoke on condition of anonymity out of fear of retribution. The departures could be seen as an early act of defiance of interim President Delcy Rodriguez's control. The other 12 are not broadcasting any signals and have not been located in new imagery. So you got some of these Russian shadow fleet boats are trying to get out of Dodge before they get seized, somewhat acting in defiance of this new president and Maduro's former vice president. So, look, guys, this is just one more example of there's a lot that hasn't been decided yet. All they did was grab Maduro and he's out of there and people are happy about that. Now what? That is the big question. And meanwhile, we have an interesting story from Saudi Arabia this morning. And I think this may be at least dotted line related to what we saw in Venezuela. Saudi Arabia tests bond market appetite with new dollar deal. Saudi Arabia is borrowing dollars, but it's who they're borrowing from that's interesting. Saudi Arabia is starting 2026 with a benchmark-sized dollar bond showing no let-up in international borrowing to help fund huge projects meant to diversify the economy from oil. The kingdom plans to sell notes with maturities ranging from 3 to 30 years, according to a person familiar with the matter. The final terms, including the size and the yields, may be announced later on Monday. Initial spread was about 95 points over that of U.S. Treasuries. Earlier this month, the Ministry of Finance approved borrowing plans that imply about $14 to $20 billion of issuance in the international bond markets this year. At the upper end, that would be broadly in line with 2025. Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Finance closed a $13 billion loan late last year. The proceeds will be used for infrastructure projects, and the facility carries a seven-year tenor. The loan was heavily marketed to Chinese banks, according to people familiar with the matter. Interesting, borrowing dollars from Chinese banks. Two countries that are supposedly de-dollarizing, trading among themselves using dollars. The loan deal was the latest in a series of transactions that have seen Saudi Arabia tap the Asian market for liquidity to diversify its funding sources. Asian banks are keen to lend amid a shortage of transactions at home. Loan volumes in Asia, excluding Japan, in dollars, euros, and yen fell to a five-year low in 2025, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Obviously, the collapse of the housing market and the development market in Asia contributing to that one. So that's an interesting story to see there. The Saudis borrowing a bunch of dollars from the Chinese to fund non-oil infrastructure projects. Regardless, guys, there's been a lot of movement in the oil majors this morning. We're looking at Chevron right now, up almost 7% ahead of the opening bell, trading at $166, up more than 10 bucks. ExxonMobil, not doing as well, up 3%, where Chevron's up almost 7%, probably because Chevron has a much bigger footprint in Venezuela, so they are expected to benefit more than ExxonMobil, although ExxonMobil also seeing some benefit here. Other names like exploration and production giant ConocoPhillips, up 5.25%, trading at $101.80 on this news. Oilfield services companies like Schlumberger, up 8.2%. Probably going to have to install a lot of pipe, replace a lot of valves. Schlumberger perfectly positioned for that one. Also, names like Halliburton up 9.1%. That'll make the Cheneys very happy. $32.30 for Halliburton. So the U.S. oil majors are all doing really well here, some better than others. Even though the price of oil isn't moving very much, the price of these stocks is. And one more thing to keep an eye on, guys. This is pretty messed up here. How one trader quickly turned a $30,000 wager on Venezuela action into $400,000. Not many saw Maduro's ousting and rendition to the U.S. being so sudden, but one trading account did. One trader quickly amassed a profit of over $400,000 through a handful of well-timed bets exclusively on the possibility the U.S. would carry out a military operation in Venezuela. Starting on December 27th, a trader made wagers on Polymarket, the popular decentralized online prediction marketplace, on Venezuela-related contracts. By early Saturday morning, the same account had placed a series of further bets on the same outcome, staking just over $30,000 in total. Not many hours later on Saturday, these bets were closed out for a profit of $409,882, around 14 times the original stake money. Each of those trades were made on contracts that traded at pennies on the dollar, with the largest of the trades that Nicolas Maduro would be out of office in a month's time at just 7 cents on the dollar. This isn't the first time this has happened, and not the first time Venezuela has been the subject of unusual betting patterns either. Back in October, a series of successful bets were placed on Venezuelan opposition leader in exile Maria Corina Machado winning the Nobel Peace Prize just 12 hours before the announcement was made public. There was the tip-off was uploads to the Nobel website. So insider trading on military actions, insider trading on the Nobel Peace Prize, And guys, it's just worth pointing out here, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., sits on the board of Polymarket and the venture capital fund where he's a partner. 1789 Capital owns a stake in Polymarket. Do we need the tinfoil hat for this one? I don't think it's necessary. I think it's pretty obvious to see what's happening there. It's just kind of messy. It's disappointing, to say the least. My God, fraud, corruption, it is everywhere. Meanwhile, U.S. auto sales are poised to slip as middle-class buyers retreat. Probably going to be talking a little bit more about this with Lox Ganapathy later this afternoon as we talk about her year ahead for 2026. Look for that one later today. But in the meantime, affordability bites. High prices threaten to send U.S. auto sales into decline this year as middle-class consumers shy away from the new vehicle purchases with stickers near record levels. While sales are expected to surpass 16 million vehicles for 2025, the annualized rate likely slowed in the final 3 months to about 15.6 million, down more than 5% from the third quarter. According to industry researcher Cox Automotive, that's a large decline that suggests a lack of momentum heading into the new year, Charlie Chesbrough, senior economist at Cox, said on a December call with reporters. The main culprit is nervousness among consumers making less than $150,000 a year who've pulled back because prices have simply gotten too high, underscoring broad consumer angst around the cost of living that has persisted throughout 2025. Cox expects the trend to continue through this year, forecasting auto sales of 15.8 million vehicles, which would mark the U.S. industry's first annual drop since 2022. The outlook reflects how growing economic inequality is changing the U.S. auto industry. New car sales have soared 45% among households with annual incomes $150,000 or more since 2019. That's according to Cox. Yet they've plunged 30% in the same period for those earning $775,000 or less, while sales dropped 7% among families with incomes between $75,000 and $150,000. So the rich are doing well. Everybody else is not. That's the K-shaped economy we've heard so much about. The people who can still afford new vehicles are buying what they want, larger premium vehicles, said Cox executive Aaron Keating. Everyone else, they didn't downgrade to a compact car. They left the new market entirely, buying either used or hanging on to what they've got. The auto market is in for a reckoning in 2026, folks, and those involved in auto finance, I might add. Meanwhile, here's a story we got to keep an eye on, guys, because we heard an awful lot about the fraud in Minnesota last week. And it's worth pointing out that welfare fraud and Medicare fraud and childcare fraud, it's not just a Minnesota story. There is a massive story that broke years ago that is still unfolding down in Mississippi. And the Wall Street Journal is talking about that one this morning. The Mississippi welfare fraud trial spotlights national oversight failures. Safety net scandal totaling at least $77 million resembles the one in Minnesota, according to a Republican auditor. The first trial in the Mississippi welfare scandal is set to begin this week, nearly 6 years after it erupted in one of America's poorest states. The scheme involving misuse of at least $77 million in federal aid given to the state under programs including the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, resembles the sprawling safety net scandal in Minnesota. That's according to Mississippi's Republican auditor, Shad White, who said publicly in recent days. He noted on X that these kinds of programs, both in Minnesota and Mississippi, were shot through with fraud. White, who for years has urged Congress to tighten oversight of TANF, said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal that the problem isn't partisan politics, but inadequate monitoring and accountability. This is so important, guys. The fraud is universal here. It's not left. It's not right. It's not white. It's not brown or black. It is they and us. It is the fraudsters and everybody else who is paying for the fraud. The average working Joe in Red, Mississippi, was upset that a whole lot of welfare money got lit on fire down here, he said. And I would hope an average working Joe in Democrat Minnesota would be just as offended. Former professional wrestler Ted DiBiase Jr., I shit you not, Ted DiBiase Jr. is the only federal defendant in the case who opted to stand trial, which is scheduled to begin Tuesday in the state capital of Jackson. DiBiase is from a well-known pro wrestling family. His father, Ted Sr., gained fame in the 1980s as the Million Dollar Man. His brother, Brett DiBiase, also wrestled professionally and was charged in the welfare fraud scheme. He pleaded guilty to state and federal charges. Apparently, the bodyguard Virgil was unavailable for comment. Federal prosecutors allege that Ted DiBiase Jr. entered into several sham contracts with a pair of nonprofit groups in a conspiracy to steal federal safety net funds, according to a 2023 indictment. They allege that DiBiase embezzled about $1.1 million and used some of the money to buy a vehicle and a boat. Under the contracts, two companies controlled by DiBiase were allegedly supposed to provide leadership outreach, assess the need for emergency food aid, and help inner-city youth. These services that DiBiase did not provide and did not intend to provide, according to the indictment. In a November court filing, DiBiase asserted that he had produced significant evidence that he did perform the work under the relevant contracts. A lawyer for DiBiase didn't respond to requests for comment. The case spotlighted other prominent Mississippians. Former NFL quarterback Brett Favre received $1.1 million in what state officials claimed were TAMF funds to promote a nonprofit group. He eventually repaid the money, and the auditor has demanded that he also pay $228,000 in interest. The interest is still being litigated. Favre also helped secure funds to build the volleyball court at the University of Southern Mississippi, his alma mater. That's state welfare funds being paid to build a volleyball court at Brett Favre's college that Brett Favre supposedly helped. Yeah, okay, great. Favre hasn't been charged with any crimes because he's a famous football player. In 2022, he issued a statement to the media saying, "I have done nothing wrong other than help embezzle money that was meant to help poor people. No one ever told me, and I didn't know," said the quarterback, playing stupid, "that the funds designated for welfare recipients were going to the university or me," he said. That's great. Fraud just runs. It's everywhere, guys. That's the point. Fraud is freaking everywhere. We do what we can to expose it on this channel. We've exposed a couple of big ones on this channel, and, well, let's be honest, in most cases, nobody really cared because fraud is so rampant, it just blends in with everything else. But we must press on. Here's another one. Tyson reaches multi-million dollar deal with direct beef buyers. This one just yesterday. Tyson Foods agreed to pay $82.5 million to settle a proposed class action lawsuit bought by grocers and other businesses that accused the meat and poultry company of conspiring to inflate U.S. beef prices by restricting supply. The proposed settlement was disclosed Wednesday in a filing in the U.S. District Court for the District of Minnesota. Attorneys for the plaintiffs said they were working on a final settlement agreement to submit to the court. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of grocery stores, food distributors, and other businesses that purchase beef products directly from Tyson Foods. Plaintiffs allege that Tyson and other major beef producers conspired to limit production and raise prices for boxed beef and retail ready cuts between 2015 and 2022. Hey, has anybody seen the price of beef lately? That's interesting. The Tyson settlement marked the second agreement reached with direct purchasers in the long-running beef antitrust litigation. JBS USA previously agreed to pay $52.5 million to resolve similar claims. That settlement, in which JBS, of course, denied wrongdoing, was approved by a judge in 2022. Tyson and JBS were the two largest defendants in the direct purchaser case. Two remaining defendants, Cargill and National Beef, did not respond to requests for comment. Tyson, the largest U.S. meat company, previously agreed to pay $55 million to settle a related consumer price-fixing claims tied to the beef litigation. The company also agreed earlier this year to pay another $85 million to resolve a proposed consumer class action lawsuit accusing it of conspiring with competitors to inflate U.S. pork prices. The beef litigation remains ongoing against the remaining defendants. You know what nobody talks about anywhere in this article is about how they're going to stop doing it. Nobody talks about that because they're not going to stop doing it. All of these settlements, smaller than the proceeds from the act itself, these are just the cost of doing business. They're not going to do anything about it. Not until regulators get involved. They're rigging prices. I thought they're not supposed to do that. Aren't we supposed to have this like free, fair, and open market? Nope, apparently not. Meanwhile, NVIDIA partner Foxconn reports a 22% revenue surge as AI build-out ramps up. Not a lot to this one, guys. They're still building data centers left and right. They're still buying chips left and right. Foxconn revenue proves it. The AI bubble is intact. That is the takeaway from this one. 22% year-over-year growth in revenue suggests that the numbers are still going to be pretty good. Meanwhile, AI-driven inflation is 2026 most overlooked risk, investors say. AI-driven inflation. Who had that one on their 2020s? Bingo. Global stock markets riding high on AI euphoria and the start of 2026 may be disregarding one of the biggest threats that could spoil the party. a surge in inflation driven partly by the tech investment boom. U.S. stock indexes where seven tech groups contributed half of all market earnings this year, made double-digit gains in 2025 to hit record highs as exuberance about AI and monetary easing propelled U.S. and also European and Asian equities to record peaks. For 2026, waves of government stimulus in the U.S., Europe, and Japan, as well as the AI boom, are expected to refuel global growth. This has money managers bracing for inflation to reaccelerate, prompting central banks to end their rate-cutting cycles, slamming the brakes on the easy money flow into AI-obsessed markets. You need a pin that pricks the bubble, and it will probably come through tighter money, said Trevor Greatham, head of multi-assets at Royal London Asset Management. He said that while he was holding on to big tech stocks for now, he would not be surprised to see inflation booming worldwide by the end of 2026. Tighter money would reduce investors' appetite for speculative tech, raising funding costs for AI projects, and reduce tech groups' profits and share prices, Greatham said. The multi-trillion dollar race by so-called hyperscalers like Microsoft, Meta, and Alphabet to build new data centers was also an inflationary force, analysts said, because of the rate at which these projects are gobbling up energy and advanced chips. The costs are going up, not down in our forecast, because there's inflation in chip costs and inflation in power costs, said Morgan Stanley strategist Andrew Streets. He said U.S. consumer price inflation would stay above the Fed's 2% target until the end of 2027, in part because of heavy corporate investment in AI. Higher power prices means higher prices for everything. And we're only now just starting to see those prices move higher. And I just want to say thank you very much to Jolly Lollipop 1 says, no fortress can resist a donkey laden with gold. Well, look, I've got security measures taken at my house, but if a donkey full of gold shows up at my front door, I'm letting him in. So I agree with that. No fortress can resist a donkey laden with gold. I'm guessing this has something to do with Venezuela. I'm not sure I get the donkey reference. Is the donkey Trump? Or is that saying Trump is an ass, or, you know, because the name is Don? But then again, the donkey, isn't that the Democrat symbol? The imagery is a little bit off there, but I get what you're saying there. And, you know, just again, full disclosure, if anybody wants to send a donkey full of gold to my house, I'm in. You don't even need my permission. Just go ahead and send that. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jolly Lollipop. Appreciate the super chat and the support of the channel. Alias Jones says, good, bad, I'm the guy with the gun. Evil Dead. Look, Mish and I were talking about that this morning. Like this whole like premise of international law. What the hell is international law? International law is things we clutch our pearls and talk about when our enemies break it. When we break it, it's just like, look, we have the big guns and we say what international law is. That's pretty much how it works. And honestly, guys, I think that's pretty much how it always worked. I think we just kind of pretended we were different for a couple of years there, but it's always been the guy with the gun makes the rules. That's pretty much how that works. Thank you, Alias Jones, for supporting the channel. Armando Reyes says, welcome to Trump's Oceania. Oceania? Oceania? Did I say that right? Yep. This was very much a Monroe Doctrine case. Absolutely. And actually, I heard the Monroe Doctrine when I was talking to Doomberg a couple of months ago, who predicted this at the beginning of the year. Doomberg was pretty much right on the money. Now, the only question is, now what? Right? I mean, that's the question. Do we end up like boots on the ground, bogged down in a guerrilla war? Worst case scenario? I freaking hope not. And the country's had enough of that. We can't afford it. They basically put a gun to this lady, that Maduro's vice president, who's now in charge. They basically said, if she doesn't do what we want, she's out of there too. And I don't think they're going to launch 100 planes to grab her when a Hellfire missile will do the job. I'm pretty sure they were threatening to kill her if she doesn't do what she wants. I mean, that's pretty much where we're at here, guys. Let's not beat around the bush. That's do what we want or we'll kill you, was the message over the weekend. Yep. That's Trump's Oceania. Thank you, Armando. And thank you, Steve Wojtas says, apparently Venezuela oil infrastructure needs upgrading to become a meaningful world supplier, and this may take years to complete. Is this true? Yes, Steve, this is true. Venezuela's oil infrastructure was built by the American oil majors in the 70s and the 80s, and then Hugo Chavez nationalized it, which means he took it. He said, thanks for investing billions of dollars in our infrastructure. It's mine now. You can't have any of the proceeds from it. That pissed off America. That pissed off American oil companies. Venezuela got sanctioned. And a funny thing happens when you rip off your business partners over and over again, and then a valve breaks, and you call them up and say, hey, I need a replacement valve for that oil rig that I stole from you. Hello? Hello? Yeah. Yeah, they're not so eager to sell you parts. They're not so eager to train your socialist cousin's imbecilic nephew who just got nepotism appointed to run the oil platform. Hey, oh, he doesn't know how to run an oil platform? It doesn't matter. He says the right thing at socialist party meetings. Next thing you know, 20 years later, they can't get the oil out of the ground. They did what socialists do everywhere. They destroyed what they took. And socialists, communists, they're indistinguishable in my opinion. This is what they always do. All right. I'm sure there's some like small arm dude in San Francisco right now who's like, oh, it's not a failure of socialism. It wasn't real socialism. Oh, another case of wasn't real socialism. It's amazing how many of those wasn't real socialisms have failed now. It's almost like there's no such thing as real socialism. There's only human greed, and socialism actually is worse for human greed, worse even than capitalism, because at least capitalism gives people the option of not doing business with greedy a-holes, where socialism puts a gun to your head and says you will do business with this greedy a-hole who claims he just wants to share. Human greed is universal, whether capitalists or socialists or not. Socialists did what they always do in Venezuela. They destroyed it. Now the capitalists are going to come in, try to get rich fixing it. And it's my hope that Venezuela sees some of that wealth, all right? Typically, the way it works is royalties are paid out. When mineral wealth is extracted, a percentage goes to the owner of that land, the owner of those mineral rights, which should be Venezuela. So hopefully some of that money starts flowing into Venezuela once that oil does start flowing. Thank you very much, Steve, for supporting the channel. T.A. Chapman says, as a Middle East vet, at least this makes more sense. Andy Scheckman on Adam Taggart, again, was interesting yesterday on the silver front. I did not see Andy Scheckman on Adam Taggart, but I would just warn guys, silver has gone up in a straight line, and there is a lot of BS floating around. I didn't see or hear what Andy said. Just be careful with the silver FOMO trade, all right? I hope silver goes higher. I'd like to see silver grind higher in a slow and steady pattern instead of shooting up in a straight line, which makes me think this is just somebody pulling our chain and it's going to crash. Just be careful, all right? And again, this AI Asian guy, if you see that, run. Thank you very much, T.A. Chapman, for supporting the channel. Armando Reyes, oh, by the way, T.A., thank you for your service, sir. I appreciate that as well. Armando Reyes says, whatever Washington wants to impose, right? We are in no rules-based order, regime change for everyone. It's kind of what they did. Look, Maduro committed the ultimate sin, all right? And it's been the downfall of many a dictator, all right? He messed with the flow of oil. All right, history is rife with examples of when you mess with the oil flow, your days are numbered. I'm surprised Maduro lasted as long as he did, as messed with the oil as much as he did. Maybe because he didn't just shut the oil off. He just slowly ran it into the ground. But look, the spice must flow. You mess with the oil, you're dead. That's going to happen. All right. I mean, Manuel Noriega messes with the Panama Canal. The tankers can't get through. He's out of there like in the blink of an eye. We've seen this before. What Gaddafi nationalizes the oil. He's out of there. Hussein, he's out of there. History has shown it. I mean, I don't know why people keep doing it, but yeah, the spice must flow. That is the lesson there. Armando back again says, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Anytime you and your wife could be arrested by a tyrannical totalitarian government. Look, what we did in Venezuela was a totalitarian action. Absolutely. Was he the leader of a sovereign country? Yup. We grabbed him and his wife overnight, took them, stole them. Let's not act like Maduro was a good person. All right. And let's look at millions of people cheering in the street. All right. Venezuelans around the world are freaking delighted that he's gone. So this is a very much moral gray area, what just happened. We did a bad thing. We did it for greedy reasons. And there's a lot of people who are really happy, people who were starving and living in abject squalor because of the guy we did it to. So ends justify the means, question mark? I don't know. But be careful. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to be out there like, Maduro was just trying to help the poor people of Venezuela. No, he was not. He was an asshole and an idiot, and he got what he deserved. Not saying it was right for us to do it, but I won't be shedding any tears for Maduro. Thank you, Armando, for supporting the channel. Nacho Man says, am average Joe working for the man that's stealing my dollars and everyone is a slave to the man? That is most of us. I suspect we're talking about the Mississippi story right now. And the reason why I spent so much time on the Mississippi story is to just show you guys all of these programs that are supposed to be helping people. They just end up being grift machines, fraud, stolen tax dollars, stolen borrowed money, money that was printed by the Fed and lent to the government, ends up being stolen. The people it's supposed to be helping never get the help. It just ends up embezzled. See also the socialist idiots in Venezuela running the oil industry into the ground. It's the same freaking thing. Fraud is universal. That's why getting the government out of these businesses is the most important thing. That is how you fix the fraud. You take away the incentive for the fraud. All these programs that are supposed to be helping the poor are making the plight of the poor worse. Because all of this fraud results in more money printing, more government spending, more inflation, which disproportionately hurts the poor. And that's why poverty keeps getting worse in this country, even though we keep shoveling and flinging and slingshotting and trebuchet catapulting more money at the problem. And it always gets worse because the money is the problem. That's why. Thank you very much, Nacho Man. Armando's back again, says Christy Noem said the Venezuelans can now seek refugee status. That's a great thing. What they couldn't before. How many Venezuelans living in this country? Yeah. Anybody could have claimed refugee status for freaking anything over the last couple of years. That is unchanged, Armando, from where it was. Thank you very much, though, for supporting the channel. Wesley Rubel says Tyson canceling poultry contracts because Oklahoma lawsuit. City of Springdale doing $120 million in bonds for Tyson to buy old cargo plant and renovate it. Why is the city doing bonds so Tyson can buy a plant and renovate it? Further consolidation in the food industry financed by municipal bonds. Finance, but gotta love it. Gotta love it. Probably one of those pilot programs, if I had to guess, Wes. I haven't heard of this particular case, but that sounds like payment in lieu of taxes or something like that in order to get Tyson to come in and buy the old plant and renovate it. I've seen that very common thing happens in New Jersey and also rife for abuse. Thank you, Wesley Rubel, for supporting the channel. Rubel or Rubble? I don't know if I said it right, but thank you, sir. Zeeble Fritz says cheap oil from Venezuela and higher silver equals good for miners. You know, watch that silver to oil ratio. It's my personal opinion that silver is not overvalued right now. I don't think it's overvalued, at least not using gold as a barometer. Silver is actually pretty fairly valued in terms of gold right now. Some people will go back 100 years and say the gold to silver ratio was much, much lower than the mid-50s where it's at now. That's accurate. I'm using the last 40 years as a barometer, not the last 400 years. Right? There's a case to be made that the older history is more accurate. I can get down with that. But for now, at least viewed in the context of the last 40 years or so, silver is not undervalued relative to gold. Now, relative to oil, silver is way overvalued. I'm not aware of any point in history where an ounce of silver was worth more than a barrel of oil. I don't know. I don't know when that has ever happened before. That gives me a little bit of pause. Not saying that means silver is bound to sell off any second now because of the price of oil. But you know, some of those guys that are big on the ratios, that's one that makes me do a double check, double take. But you're right. This is rocket fuel for miners. Cheaper energy prices. Partially offset by higher labor costs, though. The miners are seeing higher labor costs around the world. But these higher silver prices and lower energy prices, rocket fuel for the miners, which is why they've had a really good couple of months. Thank you, Zeeble Fritz, for supporting the channel. Richard Bell says Saudi move may hurt. Remember 1973. Why? Did something happen in 1973? WTF happened? Or was that 1971? It was 1971, right? I got a WTF happened. Yeah, it was 1971. What was 73? Was that the oil embargo? Is that when that started? Before my time. I was born in 1980. I know it was in the 70s. If we are talking about the oil embargo, that is one possibility I consider here. If you're OPEC and you're worried about market share and you want to prevent U.S. oil majors from developing those Venezuelan supplies and adding supply to the world that you can't control in your cartel, well, the only way you can really stop that beyond like funding a guerrilla war in Venezuela, if that's what you decide to do. But the only other way would be to flood the market with supply, crash the oil price so that the oil majors aren't willing to make that investment in Venezuela to increase the oil flow because there's no money in it. And the Saudis have done that in the past. They declared war on U.S. shale production in 2015, caused an oil bust, caused a collapse in commercial real estate prices in Houston, Texas. They're still talking about the bust in Landman. God, I love that show. It's so good. But the last time the Saudis did that, they lost. They inflicted a lot of pain. I mean, the oil price war in 2015 was a war of attrition, and the Saudis lost. Everybody got hurt, but the Saudis ultimately yielded. And as soon as the Saudis stopped flowing that extra oil, the U.S. production came right back. So I don't think Saudi Arabia is in a big hurry to go repeat that. But the alternative is for Saudi Arabia to sit there and do nothing while Venezuela becomes more U.S. aligned versus OPEC aligned, which would dramatically weaken the cartel. So I don't really know what Saudi Arabia does here, to be honest with you. They don't have many good options, which is why I put Saudi Arabia in the category of big losers in this situation, along with the Iranians, the Russians, and the Chinese. But it's going to be interesting, guys. A lot of things just got shuffled on the great big chessboard of geopolitics. There's going to be a lot of equal and opposite reactions elsewhere, reactions to those reactions. So I think there's probably going to be a lot of unforeseen consequences, good and bad. We just don't know what they're going to be yet. Thank you very much, Richard Bell, for supporting the channel, sir. And thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button. Should you feel so inclined, you new guys, thank you very much for the generosity in the Super Chat supporting the channel, as well as you magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon, YouTube, and Buy Me a Coffee. Thank you so much for supporting the channel. Links down below. Should you feel so inclined, look for that interview with Lakshmi Ganapathy from Unica's Research later today. Hi, Dan. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.